Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino online.
I was only playing for fun, so winning was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's favorite free online social casino. You, too, could have the chance to win life-changing cash prizes. Absolutely anybody could be like Mary. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and play for free now. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of the winner.
You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with WISP Sports. This is season 3, episode 13. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center, a first of its kind research center and thought leader that accelerates systems change for girls and women in sport. Tucker Center Talks is a place I and my female colleagues let the data tell the story, including data that disrupts the sport landscape. This episode of Tucker Center Talks is a disruptor segment where we draw attention to the people, organizations, and events that disrupt the status quo and the normative model of sport created by and for men. In this podcast, I'm talking to fellow disruptors, my colleagues, TC-affiliated scholars, meaning TC stands for Tucker Center, doctors Nancy Lowe, Katie LaBelle, and Dunya Antunovich. Welcome, everybody. Let's get started on this jam-packed episode of the post-Tokyo 2020 Olympics, which were actually held in 2021, which I find odd that they kept that name, but that's not the focus of the podcast. So welcome, everybody.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. So let's get into it. If you've never listened to Disruptors, this is where we all sort of pick a current topic that's disrupting the space of sport that is evidence-based because we let the data tell the story. So let's start with our first disruptor of the day. Who wants to take it away?
Well, I can jump in. I don't like to rub it in everyone's faces, but we're pretty excited here in Canada with the Canadian women's team soccer gold medal. We're still flying high from that big performance on Friday. It was super exciting. And this isn't my official disruptor, but it was kind of a disruption in Canada, to be honest. One of the things that I noticed, and I won't spend a lot of time on this, but I mean, the athletes were very gracious in all of their post-game pressers, but they pivoted really quickly to calling for greater investment in women's sport, which is actually kind of in and of itself a little bit of a disruption because, you know, typically you can imagine they're talking about the men in their lives that helped them get to their podium or the fact that they were so lucky to, be in that position to win a gold medal. And they actually skipped through right all of that and went right to, hey, we don't have a professional league in Canada. We don't have professional teams in Canada. Like making an official call to action there to get some investment. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really, really interesting and good on them for not settling and for demanding more and using their platform to educate people on that.
Mm-hmm. Now, for listeners of our first time listeners of the Disruptors segment, if you hadn't put two and two together, the first speaker is Dr. Katie LaBelle, who is in Canada at Ryerson University and is very excited about her team's women's soccer gold medal. So just make sure when you do your disruptor, for those who have listened before, just say who you are so they can associate your voice with your amazing credentials.
I was just so excited about the win.
Of course you were. I would be really upset if you didn't actually bring that up right off the bat.
Well, and excited that women weren't just being grateful to have the chance to compete, which is another a little mini disruption. The official disruption, I guess, is I got a little bit of a retail rant to go on. Retail was actually front and center for this Olympics. We had the German women's gymnastics team ditching those traditional kind of high cut leotards or unitards, I guess they are, in favor of the ankle length unitards, which were awesome. There was that big thing with the Norwegian women's beach handball. Did we see that they could only have 10 centimeters of their bum covered? Like, that was gross.
Come on, really? I didn't hear that.
That's the Federation mandate. It was 10 centimeters.
That was the official IOC mandate, but that was, that was an official Federation mandate, right?
Yeah. And they showed up wearing like just tight-fitting, like, you know, board shorts, and that was a problem. The sole caps were banned in swimming. Like, there were several retail things, but the rant that I want to go on is actually kind of tied back into the women's soccer game. When we won the semis, I went in and I wanted to buy my daughter a shirt or some merch or something. We were jazzed. We wanted to be fans. And I kid you not, I went into the largest sport retailer in Canada. I think it's like number 5 in the world. And I put in Christine Sinclair's name and Toronto Blue Jays gear came up.
Like, come on.
I kid you not. There were no women's team jerseys available in youth sizes. The women's team kits could be personalized with women's player names, but, you know, they're one of the top teams in the world, the current Olympic champions. And should the entire roster not be available for sale in all sizes for all ages and all genders?
They won a medal, but in general, they should be available. And the fact that they aren't, and now there's real demand because they won a gold medal, that's even more problematic.
Get this. They won the gold medal, and then they put out an announcement that there would be the gold medal t-shirts available in men's sizes only on August 31st.
Come on.
That's what, almost 4 weeks after they won. So my disruption is a call to action, I guess, more than anything, but just to kind of bring this to the fore, because I think the more and more I get into this, merch matters. It's a real brand building tool, and it's so taken for granted in men's sports. And I'd like to take the opportunity to argue that, again, we talk a lot about media and visibility being key to awareness. I think sport merch is really a gateway to fandom and participation. And I see that through the eyes of my daughter when she gets excited about something and wants to be able to have the opportunity to be a fan and get excited about a sport. And then I can't get her those ways to attach to the sport. We're going to lose an entire generation if we don't step up on this. That's my rant. It's more of a rant than a disruption, but it's a rant.
So I just have a question for you, Katie. Have you seen like an outpouring of frustration and people communicating that they want the merch? Because, you know, everything that we know, at least historically, is that men will, you know, contact sport editors, that they'll throw a little fit when they can't have the kind of coverage that they want, things of that nature, right? So are we actually seeing that with merchandise?
Not as much, because again, I think it's such a, I think you see it in the women's sport community. The U.S. women's national team with the World Cup was the latest example. I mean, it became the top selling jersey, men or women's, for the Nike set. And we start this drumbeat of outrage among women's sports fans, but I don't see anything changing. So I wonder, we get stuck in our little bubble. Dunia and I have talked about this a little bit, where we get stuck in our bubble and think that everybody thinks that women's sports are, you know, as big as we all live and breathe every day. I worry that it's not getting out there into the broader public, though. Again, it's such a taken for granted. I can't tell you how many times I've brought this up with people and they were like, oh, well, I just went and did a Google search and it seems okay to me. We had a big research study that we just wrapping up around the NBA and the WNBA. The WNBA had 3% of the amount of fanware and merch that was available in the NBA, less than 3%. So it's another one of those big stats that I just think we all need to be paying more attention to. I think it has big implications for fans as a brand building tool for women's sports and their growth, but also participation in a lot of ways when we talk about the younger generations.
And I think two other thoughts is that, and I've heard you say this before, Katie, is industry's leaving money on the table. right? You want to buy something. You don't want to wait till the end of August. You're moving on to your next sports season at that point. So money on the table. And two, going back to the cliche, you can't be her if you can't see her. Well, you can't be her if you can't wear her jersey. And that is also really problematic because kids, boys and girls, want to wear those jerseys as part of identity building and fan building, as you're mentioning. So, and I will put in the show notes the op-ed you wrote for the Globe and Mail around this that I thought was really insightful. So I'll put that in the show notes for listeners.
And I'll just add to that, that it's frustrating when the only merch that you can get is male sized merch, right? So right there, you're not going to buy your little girl a shirt that's going to fit a man. And a lot of us as women, we're not going to wear, you know, merch that is just made for a man. So we really need to figure out a way to create a call to action to those who produce the apparel and the merchandise and, you know, among the fan community, because I think you're absolutely right. I support you 100% that this is a way to build fandom. This is a brand building opportunity, and it's clearly a revenue generation opportunity that's being missed. So thanks for bringing it to our attention.
I would just say too, I think when you're talking about the Olympics and that next generation of fans and inspiring them, if we don't open up those pathways to fandom around women's sport, we're going to lose them. And I think that's probably the other big part of this too. If they can't attach to women's sports, they're going to find something else to attach to. So it's that whole generational that, you know, we could be losing that entire generation. Mm-hmm. With the Olympics, I think that's really important.
Well, and sport is about building community. And one of the ways you build community is you wear the gear.
Yep.
You go to any game and you look around the stands, 80 to 90% of the people have something on that signifies their team. So that's how we identify. We build community and unity and togetherness, and you feel part of something bigger than yourself. And if you can't buy the gear, then you're probably not going to be a fan, attend, et cetera. So I think you're really onto something, Katie. So everybody that's listening, this is a call to action for everybody, not just the four of us disruptors on this podcast, but for everybody that cares about women's sport. When you see something that's sold out or not sold in the size you want or not available at all, make your voice heard, period. So thank you for calling that out, Katie. That's so important.
Other banks go out of their way to make redeeming credit card rewards needlessly complicated, like how they require minimums or force you to use your rewards before reaching some arbitrary expiration date. But Discover isn't like that. With Discover, you can redeem your rewards for cash in any amount at any time, so you'll never have to jump through hoops. Unless you're like a trapezist, then by all means, go right ahead. Learn more at discover.com/redeem rewards. Terms apply.
All right, who's up next?
I can go next. This is Dunja. I'm at the Tucker Center at the University of Minnesota. My area is sports media. So the listeners can expect from me to focus on media representations and media visibility. So my data point here that I will share with the listeners is actually coming from researchers who have been doing longitudinal studies of Olympic media coverage, primarily focusing on NBC, but also on television coverage in other countries. But the data was just published by Andrew Billings, James Angelini, and Paul MacArthur on NBC's Olympic primetime coverage. And according to this data, women actually received a higher percentage of NBC's primetime coverage than men. After 17 nights, after 17 nights, the men received 42% of the coverage, and the women received nearly 58%. 8% of the coverage. This is excluding mixed sex events, which represented sort of less than 1% of the overall coverage. But this data is available on fiveringtv.com. So everybody can look at the details. But this is significant. I mean, and we can actually debate and discuss whether this is a disruption or sort of expected, right? Mm-hmm. Because for the last few Olympic Games, women were actually receiving a higher percentage of coverage on NBC primetime than men. A lot of this can be attributed to women winning medals, right? And particularly the success of US women. And so to sort of put this data in context, we see a pattern in televised coverage of the Olympics that not just in the US, but really in, I mean, I don't want to make an overgeneralization, but in multiple countries and contexts, the broadcasters tend to focus primarily on the home athletes or athletes from that particular country, and particularly the athletes that medal in events. And so I'm sure there are a lot of us collecting data right now or who have been collecting data. So I anticipate that there will be more details on this. But these are just general trends, right? That the medal counts and sort of that national identity and pride usually drives the coverage. So that's sort of the intro. And I'm sure that maybe some of you will also have comments on this data.
Dunya, I'm glad you brought that up because I saw that report and I'll also put that in the show notes so everybody can access that data, which is very good. But I like that you framed it. Is this a disruption or is this expected? And what I really liked about this data is that when you look at least for the U.S., is that 58% of the medals for the U.S. were won by women. And about 58% of all the NBC media coverage was for women's sport and female athletes. So this might, I don't know, you can prove me wrong with the data, this might be the first time in history where we have proportionate media coverage that reflects the reality of the women's sport experience and their performance. I don't know, but it was really 58 and 58.
Yes, and so I think we can talk from sort of a methodological approach, right? Like what would be considered proportionate? There were some studies that look at participation rates, right, and kind of use that as a starting point. Obviously, medal counts are really matter, even if for sort of no other reason, but because when an athlete advances, they will have additional competition opportunities, right? And so that generates more coverage. So there is that component as well. And so, but I think the fact that the researchers are situating that data in relation to the percentage of medals won is really important. Just to sort of preview some of the comments that I will likely make later on the show is, of course, the Paralympics are still coming up, right? And one of the data patterns that we see in the Paralympic Games is that women tend to receive a significantly lower percentage of coverage than the men. However, their participation numbers are so much lower than the coverage is actually higher
interesting.
In proportion to participation. So I think that participation numbers and of course medal counts matter in terms of who receives coverage and when and then we can also talk about specific sports. But I want to pause here again to see if others have comments.
I would just chime in. This is extra data for anybody that's interested in this. I don't know if you all saw the Respect Her Game report that came out as mm-hmm. well. Also some really interesting nuggets in that report, and they did some automated coding for any of the research nerds that are out there. I'm pretty interested in that. But I think that there's a lot of data being collected around this. One of the things that the Respect Her Game report actually noted was that men still make, and this was with respect to the NBC coverage of the Olympics, but they noted that men were still making up 82% of the live Olympic commentators. Mm-hmm. So I think that maybe draws us back into one of the issues, and just the control of the narratives from that respect is something to keep in mind. And they also noted around the women being exposed and sexualized quite a lot more than their male counterparts too. So, you know, there's still some work for us to do.
I did
but
like
it was a really
that,
great report.
I did like the one tiny, maybe silver lining nugget there is that they said there was only two instances of body shaming, and one was a man and one was a woman. And I thought, well, that's, it's sad that there's any, but that it was only two, and it was equal. It was equally what's the right discriminatory for one for women and one for man. But yeah, that data was good. Nancy.
Yeah. So I thought one thing to maybe put it into context, if we think about, like you were saying, you know, the proportionality of coverage and medals, if you just flip the script on the U.S. in 1996, when it was called the Women's Olympics for the U.S., right, because the inclusion of softball, volleyball, basketball, we actually had 375 men to 271 women, right? So we had more men than female athletes. And this Olympics is almost the exact opposite. And that we also had a similar proportionality of medals. So we had 58% of the medals won by men in 1996. 36% won by women in 1996, which again is almost exactly flipped to 2020, right? So it would be very interesting to look back at the media coverage and see what that looked like proportionality-wise. Like you're just saying, Nicole, did we see, you know, 58% of the coverage going to men in 1996, which I would suspect it would be far higher in 1996. But, you know, that would be sort of an interesting gauge from a historical lens to compare. And so I just wanted to add that to this piece of the conversation.
So I actually have the fiveringtv.com page open with the data from 1994 to 2020 that the researchers collected. And in Atlanta, men received 50.7% of the coverage and the women received 49.3% of the coverage. And so it's after those games that the percentages changed and women are starting to receive more than 50% of the coverage. You know, I think the other interesting aspect about this data are which sports, you know, are featured during prime time. Obviously swimming, gymnastics usually receive a high percentage of the coverage. Beach volleyball tends to do that as well. I think the swim schedule, you know, was the finals were in the morning. So that worked for NBC in terms of live events. And so I think some of it, obviously, when the events are live is also going to shape sort of the broadcast or be influenced mm-hmm. by the broadcast schedules as well.
Can I just interject? One thing I heard on NPR yesterday was that the viewership for Olympics is gone down dramatically. So all the sponsors that paid for spots during the Olympics are now going to, they had a funny term for it, but they get like free advertising now on NBC in the fall because the viewership for the Olympics was so low. So if I'm not a fan of women's sport, I could say, well, you showed so many women, nobody wanted to watch.
Like, let's not go there. I mean,
okay, but I'm just saying, I mean, certainly we don't believe that, but there will be people that do say that. So what would be the counter to that?
Well, you're absolutely right, Nicole. And that was something that, you know, Sports Business Journal kept bringing up is that the numbers for Olympic coverage were soft. And you're right that, you know, there is a contractual obligation with the networks for those who buy that level of sponsorship. And if they don't achieve certain viewership numbers, then they have to obviously make up that in their primetime coverage, which, you know, isn't something that's happened in the past. But clearly, we're still looking at a unique situation with, you know, the COVID situation that we're still in and a very unique Olympic Games. Similarly, we're looking at prime time being a very big challenge for the two markets, right? Tokyo versus the U.S. And so that always presents a challenge to the U.S. Like ratings when we have, you know, certain things, certain events that people like to follow that basically aren't getting primetime coverage. I, as a fan of women's basketball, I found it incredibly challenging to follow the U.S. women's team through the Olympic Games. You know, and that's true, right? This is what we know about women's sport fans is you have to seek it out. You have to look for it. And that was, again, really the truth for most of our team sports is as a fan of women's basketball or soccer or even volleyball. And most of the time you kind of had to, I had to seek it out with the exception, of course, of the gold medal game finally happening during prime time. So there is a couple of really significant differentials there, but I'd love to hear what Katie thinks. She had an explanation too.
Yeah, well, the research is actually showing that there's some really significant generational drop-offs in terms of viewership. And I would point to that more than, and I think I would probably argue on top of that, that what would NBC have done if the women hadn't done so well? You know, I think that could be used as a data point for our new model of sport in a lot of ways. I could spin that right around. Mm-hmm. But my grad student actually had some research before, I guess in 2020, when it was supposed to be an Olympic year before COVID hit, back in the good old days. She did some research and she found that in her sample, so this was a smaller sample, she did focus groups, but more than 60% of the sample weren't even aware it was an Olympic year. And within that, when we started to talk to them, a lot of that Gen Z population, they had fond memories of watching and consuming the games when they were young with their families, but it was not something that they had, you know, it was not something they'd cut the cords. There was accessibility issues. There were all of these different challenges. They just weren't tuned in to the Olympics or identifying with that brand anymore. So I think that's probably the larger issue here when it comes to ratings and that reliance on legacy media and the fact that our sport consumption habits are just evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to support that, Katie, this is exactly why the IOC is including skateboarding and surfing and adding some of these new sports, because they know that they're losing the younger generations. So,
and esports.
Esports. Who were the winners of the medals in skateboarding? You know, I think three of the medals went to 13-year-olds. I mean, literally, that's how you get that younger generation, because they're tuned into different sports. So you're right, Nicole, esports is a point of discussion. And, you know, at the end of the day, as a good sport marketer, our first orientation has always got to be like satisfy the needs and wants of your consumer. It's not about what we want to put out there. It's what do consumers want? Of course, our point as scholars of women's sport is that people do want women's sport. We just haven't provided it for them. So, you know, it's a little bit of that happening as well.
Yeah. And I did hear that generational piece, Katie, is that because the athletes weren't allowed to post their own video of their own performances or anything outside what NBC approved, and the runner, Elaine Thompson, temporarily her Instagram got suspended because she posted a video of her own races. You know, NBC or whoever's in the powers that be are going to have to let the athletes do some of their job for them because of this generational divide, because they're not the younger generation. I don't really think legacy media is where they're consuming sport.
The other part I would just add on that too is, and again, this is out of the research that my grad student was working on, Mahao Seem, but she found that a lot of the Gen Z, I mean, we know that they're value-based. A lot of their first associations with the Olympic brand were actually around corruption and some of the things they weren't seeing about a global games. The first words that came to mind were around some of the corruption. So they really are key. They're tuned into some of those narratives around the Olympic Games too, which I think is another big part of this as well. Mm-hmm. Just their perception of what the Olympic movement is.
So maybe just to add like a more positive slant to this, I haven't made my contribution yet. And I think the one piece that I do want to share, because I thought it was interesting, was the credit to Title IX that a number of athletes gave to their success. And of course, this is Christine Brennan's column, you know, that she wrote. And thankfully, we have Christine Brennan writing because she's also a very strong voice for women's sport and bringing visibility to women's sport. But I thought it was pretty fascinating when you have, you know, athletes who are now very successful in their 30s, some of them, and they're reflecting back saying it's because of Title IX that I'm here today. Because, you know, I quite honestly had a conversation recently with someone who knew very little about Title IX, and their perception was actually very, very negative. It was that Title IX was controversial. And, you know, so outside of our women's sport bubble, you know, again, kind of like the research you're talking about, Katie, I think it's interesting to get perceptions of what Title IX means or has meant. And so to actually see a piece written about multiple athletes giving credit to, you know, the opportunity to compete in college, to get coaching in college that was high level and got them to that next elite level, to be able to continue to compete as a professional so that they have developed at this highest of levels, right? With, you know, of course, I want to brag as a U.S. fan on our GOATs, if you will, right? Our greatest of all time athletes that set records in this Olympic Games, from Ledecky with 6 medals to, of course, Biles with her, of course, incredible accomplishments. But you think about the Sue Birds and you think about the Diana Taurasis, who now have competed in 5 Olympic Games and won 5 gold medals for a team that now has 7 gold medals. I mean, that says something about the development of women athletes and girls through our system in the U.S. And mm-hmm. along the lines of that, I think also beneficiaries have in fact been international women athletes. When we look at how many of the women on different international teams are in fact coming out of U.S. college programs. So I just mm-hmm. want to kind of give a shout out in a positive way to something that some of us old school folks are very proud of and maybe is still getting some of the credit that it deserves today.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. To give a shout out to Title IX here in the U.S. I know we have a lot of international listeners who don't have the benefit of having Title IX, but I did love hearing about all the different athletes around the world that had competed on U.S. collegiate teams and the influence that they then take back to their own countries. And I think my big picture takeaway on disruptions is more of a contextual observation, is going back to Title IX, is that here in the U.S., our women have grown up expecting to play, having the opportunity to play. As Katie mentioned, not just being grateful they get to play, but they are given equal access and resources and opportunities as their male counterparts. And because of that, they're now expecting equal pay, equal treatment, equal gear, equal flight status, and are advocating and using their own agency for their own careers, their own health and well-being, and their own bodies in ways that we have not seen women doing in the numbers we've seen it across a wide variety of issues, from mental health to mother athlete benefits and rights and payment, to transgender athlete inclusion in the Olympics, to social advocacy issues, to LGBT athletes and visibility. So I think my disruptor is that the people at the margins, women, LGBT women, women of color, are the ones that are again at the forefront of pushing for social advocacy issues that are going to be good for everybody. And those of us that are in those identities, or even those, more importantly, those that are not in those identity groups, we need to all be working together to disrupt this normative model of sport created by and for men. So as we wrap up this episode of Disruptors, everyone gets to pick, if you could compete in one Olympic sport, whether it's your sport or not. So maybe you can't pick your sport. So like mine would be tennis. So I can't pick tennis. What sport would you love to compete in if given the choice. Mine would be archery. I'm obsessed with archery. I think it's the coolest sport ever, and we never get to see it. So mine's archery.
That's a tough question. I don't know. I mean, I had secret ambitions of wanting to be a rower, but honestly, when they were closing the games yesterday, like, can you imagine getting an Olympic medal in breakdancing? I'd be terrible. I don't know how to dance at all, but just to be able to like show up to a party and be like, yep, here's my Olympic medal in breakdancing. Like, I'm kind of jazzed for that a little bit.
Wait. Did I miss? That was not a Olympic sport, was it?
For Paris 2024. That was.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'm like, whoa, I was really out of the loop on that one.
Yeah, no, I've got 3 years to prepare. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks. Katie LaBelle is gunning for the Paris Olympics in 2024, folks.
Why
All
not?
Right. We got archery and breakdancing. What else?
I would go with just because it looks so cool. And I would love to have the feeling I'd go with surfing, which was so fun to see in the Olympic Games this year. But truth of the matter, if I could have like a dream come true, I would have been on this women's basketball team, and I would have been a contributor, because what a fantastic group to watch. And I mean, just all across the board, incredible group of women to watch play.
Okay, I have one more just really quick, because I was watching it on tape, is I want to be an outside hitter in volleyball, because I'm 5'3", but I have this dream of like jumping up and like smashing it down the line. And I'm sure they don't call it a spike, but that's what I call it. So if I could have another one, that's what I do. All right, Dunja, what do you got?
Since I can't pick tennis, I'm going to keep a racket in my hand and probably pick table tennis, since the other option would be badminton. But I just don't do well where just like the pace, just no, not good. I would also take a setter position on a volleyball team. So
okay.
Those two would be my options.
Excellent. Well, I thought we'd just, you know, dream a little bit. So as we wrap up this episode of Tucker Center Talks and talking about disruptions of sport, tune in again for our Disrupters segments of Tucker Center Talks. And we all invite you to join us in drawing attention to the disruptions in sport by using the hashtag DisruptHers on your social media. You can find the show notes and links and resources to this episode at withsports.com. Look for the Tucker Center tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sports. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, with my fellow disruptors, Katie LaBelle, Nancy Lowe, and Dunja Antunovich.